Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
And now, top executives from the oil industry are on the hot seat in the Senate today as they answer charges of price gouging and profiteering from lawmakers on both sides of the aisle. Republicans have publicly rebuked their longtime oil industry allies, but Democrats charge that Republicans are only taking up the issue for political gain. Mary O'Driscoll is senior correspondent for Greenwire and Energy and Environment News in Washington, and she's just stepped out of the ongoing hearings to speak with us. Thank you, Mary.
Hi.
And can you characterize the questions the five company chiefs are getting?
Well, it's kind of hard to say. There's really no overarching theme. It's been very interesting. The questions are really focused on how do oil prices come about? How do gasoline prices come about? And they've been trying really to kind of drill down and get these executives to explain for average consumers. And it's really very difficult. You've had Lee Raymond, the CEO of ExxonMobil, essentially saying that the Saudis set the oil prices, the world oil prices, and that really didn't satisfy a whole lot of members of the committees during the questioning. So it's been focused on that. It's been focused on, you know, why are your profits so high? And once again, Mr. Raymond said, our profits are high because we're a big company. You know, our profits are huge because we are a huge company.
Well, in fact, we have a something from Lee Raymond, again, the chair of ExxonMobil, which made $10 billion in the last quarter. Let's listen.
When you look at our earnings per dollar of revenue, a true apples-to-apples comparison, we are in line with the average of all U.S. industry. Our numbers are huge because the scale of our industry is huge.
And Mary, again, what was the reaction to that?
Well, everyone, they've been very quiet about it, but during the individual questioning, it's been very interesting to watch, particularly Senator Maria Cantwell from Washington, a Democrat, and she's a member of the Commerce Committee, and asked some very pointed questions about their exports, if they have any exports. She was trying to get at the transparency of their actual markets when they have those tankers going over the seas to mm-hmm. import the oil into the U.S. and where it was with any of their domestic drilling, their domestic production, where that goes. And it was kind of unclear exactly where she was going, but it's clear, the thing that is clear during her questioning is that she's really trying to get into some of the gray areas where no one really quite knows what the market is doing. And so that was pretty interesting angle on that. But what also was really notable about this is that there are some definite partisan raw emotions going on here. Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska, the chairman of the Commerce Committee, is chairing this, and he's really holding very tight reins. He threatened at one point to close the meeting to the public because there was a bit of an eruption among the people in the audience when Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon was trying to get the executives to say that was the president right or wrong when he said that they don't need any financial incentives, such as the $2.6 billion in financial incentives that they got in the energy bill that Congress just passed. And that he said that he's going to go to the Finance Committee this week and try to get those taken out, trying to get those rescinded. And he said, will I get your support? And so people started laughing, and Ted Stevens shut that down pretty much and threatened that the next time that there's another outburst, that he's closing down the hearing.
Huh.
And he also refused to swear in the CEOs, much like 30 years ago when Scoop Jackson's committee swore in the CEOs during the last oil crisis that we had. He refused to do that this time, and there was a bit of a tussle between the Republicans and Democrats on that front as well.
Well, but we do understand that there are Republicans who are asking questions along with Democrats, and one of the topics that both, at least some Republicans and most Democrats are raising is the idea of a windfall profits tax on oil companies. Has that been raised?
Not in so many words, but yes, the Republicans have been as strong on the questioning as well. Gordon Smith, Republican from Oregon, says, you know, how is the public supposed to trust the oil industry when you are vertically integrated? You control everything from the ground to the pump. And how are we supposed to trust you when the prices are so high? He's been very pointed on that issue. And he says, you know, I'm familiar with markets as well. And if I controlled all of that from the farm to the grocery store, and I had the kinds of profits that you had, I would be hard pressed to explain how that happened.
Mary O'Driscoll.
So it's very interesting. It's some bipartisan pummeling, but there's also been some real partisan tussling between members of the committee.
Well, in the few seconds we have, Mary O'Driscoll, I just wanted to ask, the Democrats are saying the Republicans are just doing this for show. Do you get that sense?
Well, I think it's hard to point that on any one specific party. Both of them have seized on this because the public is very concerned about the price of fuel, and especially the price of natural gas and home heating oil going into the winter, with prices expected to go as high as 50% to 70% above last year's levels. And so both parties are looking for some sort of political upper hand in this, and they both seized on this. The Republicans control everything, so they're able to have these hearings. It is an interesting spectacle to be watching the Republicans asking these questions of their political benefactors.
Mary O'Driscoll, senior writer for GreenWire and Energy and Environment News. We thank you so much for stepping out of these hearings to give us this terrific update on what's going on. Mary, thank you.
Thank you.
Critics of evolution are celebrating a major win today, a day after Kansas became the first state to allow teachers to teach specific criticism of Darwin's theory of the origin of life. Four other states allow teachers to say that evolution has its critics, but now Kansas teachers can go into detail. The state's Board of Education also redefined science so that it is no longer limited to just the natural explanation of phenomena. Supporters of intelligent design, who believe that life is so complex a higher power must have been involved, had been pushing for the change. Supporters of evolution say that intelligent design is religion in disguise and outside of provable science. Well, while the state school board clears the way, the actual decision about teaching evolution will now be left up to the local school boards, and that sets the stage for additional debates in the 300 or so school districts in Kansas. Well, Donnie Palmer knows what he wants to teach. Mr. Palmer is a science teacher at Topeka West High School in Topeka, Kansas. He teaches 9th and 10th grade biology, among other things. And Mr. Palmer, we understand you're in favor of the new science standards. Why? What do they say to you?
Really, it doesn't take evolution out of the classroom. It just encourages to teach more of evolution, some of the weaknesses of the theory, as well as the pluses for the theory.
And what does that mean to you? What would you see as a weakness of the theory?
Well, just the lack of evidence of seeing one species evolve into another species, such as the lack of a fossil record this time.
These are the gaps in evolutionary theory that backers of this measure were pointing to.
Yes.
Well, you know, the Supreme Court says it's illegal to teach creationism in school. I understand you're a Christian?
Yes.
Do you think this opens the door for you to bring in other aspects besides what you see as the gaps in evolutionary theory?
No, I don't think so. I think this just encourages us to teach the weaknesses and allow the kids to look at it critically and make their own decisions.
Yeah. What are kids telling you about this? What are you hearing in the classroom?
Most of the kids don't fully understand what the debate is about.
Hmm. Do you worry? In fact, I'm looking at some of the accounts that have come out of Kansas today, and for instance, there were some high school seniors that were, did you just laugh?
Yeah.
Why? Why?
Because it's just funny how people get so upset about this topic. It's such a personal issue to them, you know.
Well, why do you think that's odd?
They think that we're trying to infuse religion into the discussion here, when really all we want good science to come out. And, you know, if evolution is good science, then it'll come out to be the better science.
Well, but some would say it already has, and that years of study have pretty much come to this scientific conclusion, and that you're turning back the clock a little bit.
I think if you look at the last 150 years, the great discoveries in science, like in microbiology and the medical fields, don't really have a lot to do with evolutionary theory.
Meaning what? Meaning
that the advances we've made we don't just apply those to the theory of evolution. We look at other aspects of science besides evolution.
Mm. Well, again, we're talking to Donnie Palmer, who's a teacher of 9th and 10th grade students, notoriously rambunctious at times, 9th and 10th graders. What do you do, Mr. Palmer, if you come across a student who says they don't want to hear about gaps in evolutionary theory, that they embrace what they call true science?
I would say if they apply the scientific method to what we're presenting in class, then they can make their own decisions as to whether they think it's good science or bad science. And that's we're trying to make them independent thinkers, not just recite facts and figures to them.
Mm-hmm. So will you be teaching the criticism of evolution as well as the criticism of evolution?
No, I just present the theory of evolution, and then we go from there. You know, if we present some of the weaknesses of it, that's fine, too.
Yeah. Do you worry that these teachings, which are going to be different in Kansas than any state, are going to affect these kids as they go on to other learning institutions?
Now, I'd have to disagree that they're different from other states. If you look at other states like Ohio and Pennsylvania, Minnesota, they've done the same thing we've done. They've opened it up where you can look at evolutionary theory in a logical light and come to your own decisions. But if you look at like Ohio and Pennsylvania, they actually present intelligent design theory as an option in the classroom, which we do not present that as an option in the classroom here in Kansas.
Yeah. What are other teachers saying? I mean, are you in the minority, the majority? Where do you position yourself on this?
I would say I'm on the minority side of this. Most teachers present evolution as a fact, and there's no question as to its validity, you know, which I think is the wrong way to present it.
How does that impact you as a teacher that you're in the minority?
Oh, I get chastised sometimes, but that's fine. I mean, when you're dealing with a theory that tries to explain the origins of life on Earth, then of course you've got to infringe upon people's religious beliefs and their personal beliefs. And, you know, for a theory like this to do that, I mean, the topic of religion has to come up.
And again, you're a science teacher, and, you know, most science doesn't have two sides. That's why it's science as opposed to opinion. So, but you're not bothered by that?
No, because it's a theory. It's not a fact yet. Yeah. And, you know, hopefully this will encourage more scientists to get involved and present more credible evidence in support of evolution, and we can, you know, address that as it comes down the pipe. Hopefully this will just encourage more science to be done.
Donnie Palmer is a 9th and 10th grade biology teacher at West Topeka High School in Topeka, Kansas. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, we're joined now by Jack Krebs. He's a teacher in Oskaloosa, but he's also vice president of Kansas Citizens for Science and a member of the Standard Writing Committee in Kansas. He writes the standards for testing and teaching. And Jack, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And just want your first thoughts on hearing Donnie Palmer, a biology teacher in Topeka.
Well, I have quite a few thoughts, and I thought that you asked some very good questions. And I think one of the most important things to understand is that the weaknesses of the theory, as you pointed out, evolution has been being critically examined for 150 years, and the conclusion of the world's biology community is that evolution is a solidly established and the best and really the only credible explanation of the diversity of life on Earth. And so those people who, for instance, believe that there's a lack of evidence for transitional forms are quite frankly uninformed.
That's Jack Krebs. He's a teacher in Oskaloosa, Kansas. He's also a member of the state's Standards Writing Committee and very much opposed to this new measure being part of the new standards of Kansas. And we'll hear much more about why he's so opposed to this and why he thinks that perhaps it may not even last. We'll be back with more with Jack Krebs in just a moment. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. We're continuing our conversation about new standards regarding evolution, which the Kansas State Board of Education approved 6-4 last night. The Kansas standards redefine science and allow for supporters of intelligent design to teach specific criticisms of Darwin's theory of evolution. With us on the line is Jack Krebs. He's a teacher in Kansas, a vice president of Kansas Citizens for Science, and he's also a member of the state committee that ultimately writes the standards for the state, and he's very much opposed to the new measures. And Jack, as we read it, these new standards do allow teachers to talk about specific criticism of evolution, but the decision does not mention creationism, that the world is only a little over 2,000 years old, and they don't openly endorse intelligent design, that a higher power created life. So what is your major concern?
The first thing is, yes, indeed, the language of the standards itself does not mention creationism or intelligent design. However, if you look at the process by which those standards have come about, if you look at the written information that has been given as rationales, there's clearly a religious intent behind these statements.
Give me an example of just, if you can, pull one.
That if you only allow natural explanations for things, which is what science does, then you are inherently siding with atheism. And this position really disenfranchises this huge middle ground of Christians who believe in God and accept evolution.
You know, Jack Krebs, I think I want to interrupt for just a second because I do think you're onto something. We see the polls that show that many Americans, when asked if they believe that there might have been some force behind the creation of the world, they say, well, yes.
Sure.
And then they are usually assigned in the category of people who believe in intelligent design.
That's right. And that's those polls, because of the ambiguity of their questions, are misleading, if not, you know, totally worthless.
Because as you point out, you can believe in evolution and believe that there's a God.
Many people do.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
But what about Donnie Palmer's point that it gets kids to think? If you present theories but give alternate theories as well, it gets kids to think for themselves.
Number one, there is no theory of ID. It is a very misleading thing to say that there are two theories here. And Donnie Palmer, as a science teacher, this is disconcerting, is not correctly understanding what theories are. But when he said evolution is just a theory, it's not a fact yet. Theories don't become facts. Theories explain facts. And the theory of evolution is the theory which is the broad, overarching explanation of millions of facts. Intelligent design has no theory. It's just a statement that says some parts of the world must have been intelligently designed. So it's misleading to call them both theories.
Well, and as opponents of intelligent design say, it's beyond the bounds of science because it can't be tested.
Absolutely. Donnie Palmer said we ought to teach this and let the kids decide. This is a very odd thing to say because the evidence supporting evolution is so deep that you don't even begin to teach that evidence in a ninth grade biology class. So it is extremely odd to think that kids who are just learning the generally accepted conclusions of science should be allowed on that basis to make up their own mind about something that there are whole graduate degree programs in discussing and examining the evidence that supports those conclusions.
Well, Jack Krebs, you are one of the people who writes the standards for the schools.
Yes.
What do you anticipate is going to happen? We understand that decisions about teaching evolution will now be left up to local school boards. Does that mean that there are some teachers who will be teaching this and some who won't?
Here's the deal. First of all, in Kansas, curriculum decisions are local decisions. However, I think the biggest danger of what was passed yesterday is represented by talking to Donnie Palmer. Here we have a biology teacher who, in fact, does not accept the fundamental conclusions of the field which he teaches. And so now he feels that these simplistic arguments that I can teach the weaknesses of evolution and let the kids make up their mind, he now has a green light to do that in a way that he didn't before.
Well, and Donnie Palmer's told us what he's going to teach, but does that mean that somebody in the room next to him may not be teaching the same thing? So is there going to be an unevenness in the Kansas schools?
Oh, absolutely. And this is one of, again, the insidious result of the standards are that instead of there being state support for evolution, as it's understood by the science community, we now have 300 school districts in Kansas, and who knows how many biology teachers who are going to be beginning to make individual choices about this. And so those teachers who have a creationist leaning are now going to be able to come in and offer these statements, which are confusing and not supported by science, to children under the guise of letting children make up their mind.
You are part of the group that writes the standards. Is criticism of evolution going to be included in the state testing?
Well, no. Because of the delays in getting these standards adopted, because it's now November, they would not even become a part of the next cycle of standards until next fall from a practical point of view. And then tests will have to be made on them. Now, we're going to have elections for a new school board in August. If this board loses its majority, these bad standards will be thrown out.
Well, in addition, we understand the board rewrote the definition of science.
Well, yes, they did. And this is a key issue that the old standards say that science is the human activity of seeking natural explanations. They've taken out the word natural and added and instead included the word adequate, which on the surface may seem innocuous. But if you read their background rationale, it makes it extremely clear that what they want is to include the possibility of supernatural explanations in science.
And it raises the question, even though we're concentrating on evolution, do you think there are other issues that are going to come before the board where people think there's a more supernatural or spiritual explanation for science?
Absolutely. The long-term goal of this movement is to add a theistic interpretation to law and government and culture in general.
That's Jack Krebs. He's a teacher in Kansas, also a member of the state's Standards Writing Committee in Kansas, and obviously we'll have to wrestle with how to put this in the new standards for the state. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now. Here and Now. He's back. Ahmed Chalabi, the Iraqi exile who was the darling of the neoconservatives in the run-up to war but fell from grace after allegations that he leaked U.S. intelligence to Iran, is back in Washington meeting with Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and others. Before the war, the U.S. government paid millions of dollars to Mr. Chalabi to supply intelligence about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, information that later turned out to be false. After the war, Mr. Chalabi was charged with leaking intelligence to Iran, and U.S. authorities ordered Iraqi troops to raid his headquarters. Ahmed Chalabi is now a deputy prime minister in Iraq. Reporter Scott Paltrow of the Wall Street Journal has been following this story. And Scott, just a year ago, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice promised a full criminal investigation into Ahmed Chalabi's alleged leak of intelligence to Iran. Now Chalabi's in Washington meeting with her and others. What's going on?
Well, he seems to be the cat who has 9 or 10 or 11 lives. The U.S. was behind the raid, backed the Iraqi policeman that raided his place. He seemed to have betrayed us in terms of giving us information about weapons of mass destruction that turned out to be false. And then, according to the information from the administration, suspected at least of leaking, you know, the fact that we had broken the Iranian code, leaking that to the Iranians. Yet now we are back doing business with him, and I think there are multiple reasons. He is a very adept, clever individual. He has a PhD in mathematics from the University of Chicago, comes from a very wealthy, well-connected Iraqi family, and he is able to do business with people on both sides. He, after the break with the United States, he aligned himself with the leading hardline Shiite rebel cleric, Muqtada Sadr, and got into the good graces of the leading Shia cleric overall, the Grand Ayatollah al-Sistani, and he is able to hold talks and maintain relations with the Iranians. He was in Tehran just this past weekend. And so the United States at this point, with things being as bad as they are in Iraq, are saying, well, maybe we should do business with him.
And, you know, the story of Ahmed Chalabi seems to illustrate the difficult terrain the U.S. is confronting in Iraq, because, as you are pointing out, he has very close ties with the Iranians and yet is has been at times an ally of the U.S.
Right. We're obviously in very ticklish situation in the Middle East, certainly vis-a-vis our relationship with the Iranians. The hardline Iranian president not too long ago said that he would wipe Israel off the face of the earth. And Chalabi seems to be someone who can sort of mediate between the U.S. and Iran, which is very important to smoothing out whatever is going to happen in Iraq.
What do you think is going to happen in the investigation into the possible leak of information to Iran? Why hasn't that gone anywhere?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and I don't, well, certainly I haven't been able to get to the bottom of that. Condoleezza Rice, when she was the National Security Advisor, said in June of 2004 that there would be a full FBI investigation. It was reported that the information that he leaked was very damaging to national security, if indeed he did leak it. This was at a time when the United States was trying to monitor Iran's development of nuclear weapons, trying to monitor what was going on with Iranian agents in Iraq.
And Scott, I interrupt just to say that it's thought that he did leak this information because cables were reportedly discovered between an Iranian official in Iraq and his higher-ups in Iran saying that Chalabi had told him information.
Right. That was the word that came from intelligence sources. But obviously he hasn't been charged with anything. And meanwhile, the investigation, which was supposed to have launched, interestingly, does not seem to have progressed very far. Chalabi himself has not been interviewed by the FBI. His attorney in Boston had sent a letter back in June 2004, saying he wants to come to the United States, meet with the FBI, meet with law enforcement officials, answer all questions, and help with the investigation. And he never got a response. And both the FBI and Justice Department won't comment on that, but it's clear that he, in fact, has not been interviewed, nor has people in the Pentagon and the White House who had very close ties with him and who may have had information about the code.
Well, meanwhile, Senate Democrats are also calling for a full investigation into the role Mr. Chalabi played in the run-up to war, providing, as we said, faulty intelligence about Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction. Are there charges there?
Well, I think they certainly want to interview him. The Democrats definitely want to get to the bottom of how the pre-Iraq intelligence was used by the administration and whether perhaps it had been manipulated improperly. And Chalabi is certainly a key person to interview since he was supplying that.
Mr. Chalabi provided that faulty intelligence. Is there any sense that he created it?
There is a definite suspicion, and this has been raised, for example, in the Silverman-Robb report that came out earlier this year on U.S. intelligence and weapons of mass destruction, that there was a deliberate intent to, on the part of the members of Chalabi's Iraqi National Congress, that passed the information to tell the administration what it wanted to hear, and also to pass on information that was deliberately intended to foment overthrowing Saddam.
Well, Mr. Chalabi is now a deputy prime minister in Iraq in charge of overseeing the oil ministry. He's running for office in the December 15th elections. What do you think, Scott, are the chances that he might become the next prime minister of Iraq?
Well, from what I understand, the chances actually are rather slim now. He had been part of the leading group of Shiite coalition running in the election, but then he broke with it for various reasons, some of which are unclear, but he, for example, has had a much more moderate position vis-a-vis Israel, and there's been talk that he would recognize Israel, and so there was a separation. And because he's now not part of that coalition, the polling in Iraq seems to indicate that his chances are greatly reduced.
Well, I want to ask you one last thing. Neoconservative Richard Perle, one of the architects of the war and a big supporter of Ahmed Chalabi, is saying today that the Bush administration should never have pushed Mr. Chalabi aside, should have continued to work closely with him, and quoting Richard Perle, had we done so, I think we would be a lot better off in Iraq today. Your thoughts?
Well, it seems very odd. I mean, here is a man that we have accused several times of betraying us, and yet they're saying that, well, we should just have turned our cheek to that and continue to do business. It's a little difficult to understand. But
I think it's a glimpse at how Washington sometimes has to work.
Well, I think it's how Washington sometimes does work. The extent to which people are willing to deal with unsavory characters and whether the calculations made in favor of dealing with them really are justified and really will produce the benefits that some people think they will.
Scott Paltrow, reporter with The Wall Street Journal, speaking about Ahmed Chalabi, the Iraqi exile, now deputy prime minister in Iraq in charge of overseeing the oil ministry, visiting Washington today. Scott, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And this look ahead, still to come, an economist explains why that cup of coffee costs so much, and he found at least part of his answer in 18th century agriculture. You're listening to Here and Now. This fall, visitors to the intimate Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum here in Boston have a chance to feast their eyes and their ears. The exhibit, Variations on a Theme by Sol LeWitt and Paula Robeson, is the latest brainchild of contemporary art curator Pirana Cavalcini, who invited conceptual artist LeWitt to create walls with lines of color, while Robeson and other musicians fill the gallery with Mozart. Music critic Mark Kroll speaks with flutist Paula Robeson about the collaboration, which you can see at here-now.org.
When I'm involved in a musical adventure with other colleagues, the music actually does flow from one person to another. You can almost see it. So when we're sitting in that room, the lines through all the walls, curlicuing with bright colors and sunshine and light and shade, is the music.
Is the viola any color? Is the flute a different color? one reviewer actually mentioned that they thought the viola was purple and the flute was blue.
Chakras, high up there, spiritual things. That's okay. Good. Yes, well, colors are very much a part of what we do, of course. And Mozart, when he was writing, he put all kinds of colors and emotions and joy and sadness. What is so extraordinary to me about Mozart's music is that he can be joyous one moment, and by the next second, he can be plunged into the deepest sadness. And then he's back with joy. This is the way Sol LeWitt, actually, although he's quiet when you meet him and you talk to him, he has a marvelous sense of humor. And so suddenly it'll come sparkling out of his face, and he'll laugh, and his whole face comes alive with his joy. And so to have him put all of that onto a wall, when we play in that room, we are absolutely amazed, and we are united with the people who are sitting there. The room only holds about 25 to 30 people. Everyone's sitting on little stools, and everyone, we're all in it together. Your life has changed when you hear a work of art like that piece of Mozart and look at those walls. And that's what we've been actually hearing from people as they leave the room.
Now, you're performing this 54 different times.
That's right.
So 54 different experiences, right?
Yes.
For audience, for performer.
Absolutely.
Right. What thoughts?
Yes, it changes every day. It changes. We look and see who's there. Sometimes there are children there. Sometimes there are older people there. There was a whole group from Scotland there, from Edinburgh the other day.
What do they say? Do you remember any of the things they said? Did they say, besides, of course, wonderful performance, right? But
what I want them to do is be in the music with us. This is the hope of all the four of us who go into that room to play. And what people have been saying is that that indeed has happened. A woman said, well, I've seen art and listened to music at the same time. But to be in a room like this where actually the music becomes the art and the art becomes the music, that is what happens in there, and it's magic.
Is Sol LeWitt, will he ever change his installation to match your Mozart?
I actually see it a little differently, and Pieranna Cavalcini and I discussed this as we were discussing the show. Because I was saying, well, I'm an interpretive artist. I interpret the work of composers. She said, no, you are not. You are a creator. When you are doing these, when you are playing, you are a creator. And I do think that we are, Mark. I think that we are the music, because a composer writes down notes on a piece of paper, and if it weren't for us bringing them to life, we are part of the continuum. It's not as though the music ever stops. It will exist always. It goes out, someone said, any note that's played goes out into space and continues for infinity. And I believe that that is true of art. And as an interpretive artist, that's how I see my mission, actually. I feel I was put here to play the flute and to be the voice, in this case, for Mozart, and the collaborator and agreeer, confirmer of the art which is on the walls.
Flutist Paula Robeson speaking with music critic Mark Kroll. Variations on a Theme by Sol LeWitt and Paula Robeson is now at Boston's Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us, more ahead here and now. And now, do you ever wonder why the price of a Starbucks cappuccino is so high, or why supermarkets sell apples that are bagged and apples that are not? Well, Financial Times columnist Tim Harford has been walking the aisles to find the answers, and he shares them in his new book, The Undercover Economist, exposing why the rich are rich, the poor are poor, and why you can never buy a decent used car. And he joins us from a studio in Washington. Hi there, Tim.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Let's go to that first question, because I know when a lot of people ask themselves why Starbucks cappuccino costs so much, their answer is that, coffee pickers are exploited and the owner of Starbucks must be getting filthy rich. But you write that another reason is not because the owner of Starbucks is making so much money, but because someone else is. Explain.
Well, I don't know how common Starbucks are in Boston. Do you have any of them around there?
The question is there a block that doesn't have one?
I see. Well, in that case, they've got the same policy as they have in Washington, D.C., which is to put themselves every single street corner and throw themselves in your way. Now, a lot of people think that that is the mark of Starbucks' power. But the undercover economist sees something else. The undercover economist thinks, well, this is the mark of Starbucks' vulnerability. And here's the contrast. You know, the DMV, the Department of Motor Vehicles, for some reason, they don't put themselves in every street corner. And the reason is, if you've got a problem with your license, you have to go to them. Mm-hmm. They don't come to you. And now that's power.
But Starbucks, in fact, has to take up a lot of real estate. Otherwise, other coffee sellers will.
Absolutely. They are terrified that I will buy my coffee somewhere else. And they should be, because I'd buy my coffee from any other coffee seller without a moment's hesitation. So they're desperate to get the very best real estate. And the reason that the fact that they're desperate to get the very best real estate means that they have to pay through the nose for it. That means that the landlords are the ones really making the money out of the coffee boom.
Because they know they can charge pretty much whatever they'd like because Starbucks really needs the real estate.
Absolutely. And the more that customers are willing to pay for cappuccino, the higher the rents can go.
Well, you explain further that it's all about the meadow, because you compare this story to the struggle over farmland in the 18th century to explain basic economic principles today. Tell us more.
Yeah, and that's not because I find 18th century farming fascinating, because believe me, I don't. But it's because the power of David Ricardo, who was a very successful member of parliament and also a very successful financial investor, who wanted to understand why corn prices had gone so high just during the Napoleonic Wars. He produced this analysis that explained exactly why corn prices were so high, and it was all traced back to agricultural rents. But it's the same reason that Starbucks prices are so high, because of the rents of the top locations in our great cities where Starbucks likes to locate itself. Mm-hmm. So what's interesting to me is not agriculture, but the fact that over 200 years ago, an economist can write a theory that still applies to this 21st century phenomenon.
That theory being that the meadows where the corn was being raised were more expensive real estate in that day.
The meadows are the ideal place to grow corn, and the street corners of Boston, Washington, D.C., and Manhattan are the ideal places to harvest customers willing to pay a lot of money for cappuccino.
Aha. You, the undercover economist, explore other things in the book. Let's move to supermarkets, because you skulked, I think is the appropriate word, through many and found some sort of sneaky stuff going on that we might want to know about, how supermarkets kind of figure out who will pay more and then they charge that.
Absolutely. It's funny, if you start walking through supermarkets with a clipboard, you make them very nervous, but I really enjoyed that. I have to say, after a while looking at what supermarkets were doing, I started to get very paranoid. You see all these different tricks, but all the different tricks boil down to one thing. They are trying to work out who is looking at the prices and who is not. And all kinds of things that supermarkets do are designed to split their customers in two. You know, the guys who are watching the labels, the guys who aren't. So here's an example. You might find bagged produce and loose produce. And sometimes the loose produce will be more expensive and sometimes the bagged produce will be more expensive. If you just go and grab whichever, say it's potatoes, whichever potatoes are closest, well, 50-50 chance you're going to pay more. If you look and you compare, you'll pay less.
And tell us, what does all of this have to do with how supermarkets feel about grandmothers?
Look, grandmother is the supermarket's worst nightmare. Imagine a little town that has two supermarkets and a whole bunch of grandmothers. The grandmothers are always looking at the prices. So if one supermarket tries to raise prices even a little bit, all the grandmothers will flock to the other supermarket. So supermarkets will compete very, very intensely. If you imagine a different town where there are no grandmothers and, you know, they're just, it's full of yuppies and rich young things who don't look at prices, if a supermarket tries to edge up prices a little bit, they'll find that they don't really lose any customers. Then the other supermarket can edge up prices. Then the other supermarket can edge up prices. So the presence of the grannies is keeping prices down. And of course, you know, the supermarkets want to take grandmother out of the picture. So what they do, you know, they have those special dog whistles that only dogs can hear.
Mm.
Well, supermarkets have special price cuts that only grandmothers can see, and they're called coupons. And, you know, you and I probably don't use coupons. Grandmothers do use coupons. It's a way of targeting the price cut only at the grandmothers, where it doesn't get in the way of all their other customers who are willing to pay a ton of money. Then the supermarkets keep offering deeper and deeper coupon discounts for the grannies, and they're able to raise their prices higher and higher and higher. So
for everyone else,
the coupons are bad news for the rest of us.
Tim Harford is author of Undercover Economist, exposing why the rich are rich, the poor are poor, and why you can never buy a decent used car. He looks at the underlying reasons for the economic headlines. Tim, if there's one takeaway thing from the book, what would you want us to know?
How to buy a cheaper cappuccino from Starbucks. Would you like to know?
Yeah.
Okay. Ask for a short cappuccino. Short cappuccino is not on the menu, but you go into any Starbucks in the world, and I've never been refused. They will serve you a short cappuccino. They know exactly what you want. They'll charge you less, and they'll make you a little 8-ounce drink, which is quite dinky. I've got one in front of me right here. And it tastes better. The World Barista Championships officially sanction a smaller cappuccino. It's cheaper. And, you know, all you have to do is ask. Do you want to know the reason they don't advertise it?
Yes.
The reason is they make a lot more money on their bigger drinks, because all of the costs are basically staff time, rent, etc., as we've already discussed. So the bigger the drink they can get you to buy, the more money they make from you. If they offer really nice small drinks and they tell you all about them, then they lose too much custom. But they have to have that small cappuccino there just for the connoisseurs like me and like you, Robin, and now like everybody else listening out there who's going to go into Starbucks and buy them.
Well, I have to say, I'm not a coffee drinker myself, but let's put in a plug, as long as we're discussing Starbucks at such great length, for fair trade coffee.
Well, you have to be careful when you're buying fair trade coffee. And the reason is that some coffee chains, not all, I should hasten to add, but some coffee chains have used this as, yet again, a way to find out who is paying attention. The truth is, if you put fair trade coffee in a cappuccino, there's very little coffee in there. It doesn't really cost any more money to make the cappuccino. There's maybe 1 cent worth of coffee. And if you have fair trade cappuccino, that's 2 cents worth of coffee, because the fair trade coffee is more expensive. So it doesn't cost any more to serve you a fair trade cappuccino. But some coffee chains are charging more for fair trade cappuccino. They'll charge you 10 cents more or 20 cents more. And it's not because they're trying to discourage fair trade. It's just because it's a way of identifying customers who don't seem to care about the price. So while I wouldn't say avoid fair trade coffee, I would say avoid any coffee vendor who tries to charge you for it.
Tim Harford, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tim Harford is author of the new book, The Undercover Economist. He spoke to us from the offices of his home paper, The Financial Times. Buyer beware. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.